good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live for an hour each weekday afternoon taking your calls if you have questions about the Bible or about the Christian faith. Feel free to give me a call. The number to call in this hour is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. Few announcements. One of them has to do with tonight. The first Wednesday of every month, we have a Zoom meeting. Anyone listening to this program around the world is welcome to join us tonight. It's at 7 o'clock in the evening Pacific time. So I don't know what time that is where you live, but if you'd like to join us, you're welcome to do so. The log-on information to get onto that Zoom meeting tonight is found at our website, thenarrowpath.com. Under announcements. Now, also under those announcements, the place that I'll be speaking for the next few days in the St. Louis area are listed. I'm speaking at Friday night, Calvary Chapel, Troy, Missouri, which is very close to St. Louis. It's a meeting open for anybody, although if you have young people, I mean teenagers probably, I think I'm going to be directing my comments especially to young people. So if you have teenagers that might be willing to come, I'd be glad to have them in the audience, as well as yourself. That's at Calvary Chapel in Troy, Missouri. That's Friday night at 7 p.m. On Saturday, I'm speaking at two places. One is in Wentzville, Missouri, at a gospel festival in Wentzville at the Rotary Park in Wentzville, Missouri. And I'll speak twice there, and then that night I'm speaking in Alton, Illinois. And likewise Sunday morning, same location in Alton, Illinois. So there's quite a few places I'll be speaking in the next, well, between now and Sunday, actually. If you're interested in any of them, you can go to our website, thenarrowpath.com, and look at those dates and look at those places. If you happen to be nearby, join us. If you're not even nearby but want to join the Zoom meeting tonight, please do. And one other thing I'll just say as a heads up, and that is that next month we're coming to do an itinerary in the Seattle area. And we know I have a lot of listeners in Seattle. In fact, a lot of people come out to our meetings there. So if you're interested in those meetings, just so you'll know in advance, in October, we will be in Seattle area. And speaking in quite a few places, as far north as Arlington, as far south as, I'm not sure, maybe Tacoma, I'm not sure. So we're kind of all over the place for several days. If you are in the Seattle area, you might want to check our schedule there at thenarrowpath.com under announcements. All right, enough of that. Let's go to the phones and talk first of all to Greg, who's calling from Phoenix, Arizona. Greg, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Steve. Thank you for taking a call. Question about Micah chapter 5,
yeah.
It talks about a ruler coming out of Bethlehem, and is this talking about Jesus, or am I reading this out of context?
No, this is about the Messiah. Micah, like several of other prophets, likened the Messiah to a shepherd. And of course, the quintessential shepherd in Israel's history was David, who was himself born in Bethlehem, but it also says that God's going to bring another shepherd of Israel who will come out of Bethlehem also. And so in Micah 5:2, he says, "But you, Bethlehem, Ephrathah," which is another name for Bethlehem, "though you are little among the thousands of Judah, yet out of you shall come to me the one who is to be the ruler in Israel, whose goings forth have been from of old, from everlasting." It says, "Therefore he shall give them up until the time that she who is in labor has given birth." And he says in verse 4, "He shall stand and feed his flock," that is like a shepherd does, "in the strength of the Lord." A lot of these lines in Micah resemble similar lines in Isaiah. In fact, Micah and Isaiah were contemporaries, and there's one passage in Micah that's almost almost clearly taken from Isaiah chapter 2. This is a messianic passage, which means that it's talking about the Messiah. And it is a reference to him being born in Bethlehem. Now, this is not just a Christian interpretation of this. You know, obviously Jesus was born in Bethlehem, so Christians might point this out. And some might say, well, this that's not necessarily about the Messiah, is it? Well, yes, it certainly is. Even the Jews thought so themselves when the wise men came from the east to Jerusalem and asked King Herod where the Messiah would be born. Herod himself didn't know, so he consulted with the Jewish biblical scholars, and they said, well, he's going to be born in Bethlehem because, and then they quoted this verse in Micah 5:2. So the Jewish scholars, even before Jesus ever appeared on the scene, recognized this as a prophecy about the Messiah being born in Bethlehem. All right?
Awesome. I appreciate it, Steve. Thank you so much.
Okay. God bless you, Greg. Rez from Los Angeles, California. Usually Rez is calling from San Francisco or somewhere like that. Hi, Rez.
Hey, Steve. Yeah, I don't know why they said Los Angeles. Just a quick comment and a question. But I think some of the prophecies in the Bible could be used to talk about a lot of times in history. I mean, not almost the way a psychic will give a reading and then people will go, oh, that's about me, you know, in this time and that time. Now, I don't have anything specific that I'm talking about in terms of one particular prophecy.
Well, that's too bad, because it'd be great. It'd be great if you had something specific we could look at, because although there are some prophecies about national destruction of certain nations, which are not exactly simple to pin down the exact event they're predicting, I wouldn't say that most of them in their context would allow for any number of possible interpretations. I would say there's some, like the prophecy of Gog and Magog, that is ambiguous enough that some people, there'd be probably several possible interpretations of what the fulfillment of that is. But certainly the vast majority of the prophecies in the Bible are, you know, what they're talking about is fairly clear from context. I mean, in Isaiah, for example, the first part of Isaiah, he's talking about the Assyrians coming, and when it talks about Edom or Moab or Ammon being wiped out, it's talking about them being wiped out by the Assyrians, or even when it talks about Israel being wiped out. That only really happened once in Old Testament times. And likewise, you know, Jeremiah and Ezekiel are talking about the Babylonians coming and wiping out Jerusalem or other nations, sometimes mentioned. So the minor prophets likewise. And some of the prophecies have actual limits on the time, like Daniel's 70 weeks and so forth. So I'm not really sure which specific prophecies you're thinking of. Did you run into one in particular that you thought, was that true?
No, I think, like you said, I've been taking them out of context, possibly, which...
That's not ever a good idea if you're hoping to understand what the prophecy is about. By the way, there's a weird sound on your line. I'm going to have to get off because it's a disturbing electronic buzz or something that's coming on once in a while. But I don't think that the problem is very great that you mentioned. That is, of the prophecies in the Bible being so ambiguous that they could be said to apply to any number of things. I don't think that's true. It is true, as you pointed out, that, say, horoscopes and even Nostradamus' verses and many other what I would consider to be not reliable prophetic sources, they are often vague enough that you would have no idea what they're really talking about. But the Bible, I don't know, there's not very many prophecies in the Bible that I have difficulty knowing what they're talking about from the context, although there are a few. I mean, there'd be a very few. The majority of them are not that way, though. Okay, let's talk to Mike from Albany, Oregon. Hi, Mike. Good to hear from you.
Hi, Steve.
Hey.
I've been listening to talk with a few different people about like leaving Christianity and about how people have integrity. And I agree with that in most cases, I think. But I was wondering, what are your thoughts on, like, blame should really be also maybe on bad Bible teachers? Because, for example, I mean, Mormonism is a special case, obviously, but... you know, a lot of the people who leave Mormonism, Mormonism teaches that all other forms of Christianity have problems. And then it teaches really problematic kind of, you know, it teaches very problematic things about Jesus. And So when a lot of people leave Mormonism, they're leaving it because they have integrity, not the other way around.
Mm-hmm.
But they're completely ignorant, and they've lost confidence and trust in, and they don't really even know. I imagine that could be the case for someone who's just grown up with bad Christianity, like Bart Ehrman, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Seems like he had some really weird ideas about
about before he went to college. He had some verse things, right? Yeah.
Right. Right. So, do you feel like people could have integrity and believe in Christianity and be ignorant because of that? And how much, I don't know, how much of the blame do you think we should, be looking towards, ourselves as Christians? Like, what are we doing to cause this? And
sure. Well, let me just address that. As a lifelong Mormon yourself, before your conversion a few years ago to Christianity, you know very well that your reasons for leaving Mormonism were matters of integrity, because you researched it. You were actually fairly, as I recall, very studious as a Mormon. And when you used to call me years ago, you were doing so defending Mormonism, and I always thought of you as a very knowledgeable Mormon who had done his homework and so forth, as you did. But it was the very fact that you did that that caused you to realize that Mormonism had to be abandoned, because it was, well, it was based on many false assumptions. And and so you came into Christianity, which many Mormons do not, as you know. Many Mormons leave Mormonism and just become atheists. And I've always suspected it was for the reason you just gave, that, you know, they've been indoctrinated in Mormonism not to trust any other form of Christianity. So when they leave Mormonism, Christianity is not one of the places they naturally want to go and look. And so obviously no other religion has an evidential base behind it. Hinduism, Buddhism, Islam. I mean, these are religions that some people are attracted to, but they don't have any evidential base. You can't really bring evidence forward that they are true religions like you can with Christianity. But if someone's already decided, well, Christianity is the one place I've been taught not to look, well, then they won't look there. So I do believe that people often leave cults and false religions because of their integrity. Now, it's a fairly rare case that somebody who's committed to a religion actually does objective research of the kind of information that would lead them to question their religion, because it means they're looking into the criticisms of their religion with some objectivity, which is rare but commendable. And but the thing is, if people have rejected Christianity, as you said, it may well be out of ignorance. But, you know, and you wonder whether maybe sometimes the people who taught them, or maybe we should look at ourselves and see if anything we've done or said might lead them to be questioning the validity of Christianity. Well, of course, we all ought to be looking at ourselves that way. We all ought to ask, Lord, is it I? Did I do something? Did I say something that turned somebody off from you? But the truth is, everyone really has their own responsibility to look into the things that matter in life. I mean, there's a whole mentality among many people that is to just not pay any attention to things that matter and just seek every kind of diversion and distraction with whatever, you know, game consoles and social media and Netflix and whatever else can keep their mind off of things that are important. And that, I think, people can be entirely blamed for. Now, maybe not children. I mean, children, if they get addicted to those kinds of distractions, obviously, you know, there's some, I think, a measure of grace has to be offered to them for not having done deep philosophical study at their age. But when someone reaches adult life and they have a fully formed brain and adult responsibilities, I think one of those responsibilities is to seek to know what ultimate truth is. And we live in a time where that's not a very difficult thing to find, because we have a lot of research, a lot of archaeology, a lot of, debates online that you can listen to and so forth, where you can hear both sides of a thing. And it seems to me like nobody who really wants to know the truth has any excuse for not being able to find it. Now, I could see if somebody's greatly indoctrinated in another belief system than Christianity, that they might not just, turn on a dime and become believers in Christianity. I think they'd have to probably be convinced, just like even as a Christian, it has taken years for me to become convinced of certain doctrinal things within Christianity that are different than what I was taught. So we have to allow that some people's ignorance may be slow in being alleviated, and that may not be entirely their fault. I mean, people tend to, if somebody is saying, well, I need to be convinced before I take a position, I commend them for that. I think they should be convinced. But I don't think they should be holding up a standard that is unreasonable before they will allow themselves to be convinced. For example, when people, I think you mentioned people who leave the Christian faith out of their integrity or whatever. Well, if it is indeed out of integrity, it's out of ignorance. Because I think you've probably heard me say before, I believe everyone who doesn't believe in Christianity has got to, that's got to be chalked up either to ignorance or to lack of integrity. And although that sounds very, that might sound very unkind, actually to say that people are ignorant is not unkind, because everybody's ignorant of things. I'm ignorant of many things. To be ignorant means they just don't know. And most people do not know very much about the evidences for Christianity. To say they're ignorant of them is not a put-down. It's just an observation. If they don't know them, then by definition, they're ignorant of them, just like I'm ignorant of the sports statistics for any given sports team because I don't know anything about them. You know, being ignorant simply means you don't know. Now, being dishonest is another thing. You can certainly be blamed for that. I believe that when a person has known Christianity, and a lot of preachers even are saying they're deconstructing and they're obviously giving up their former Christian beliefs. I think they would say, well, that's just my integrity. No, it isn't. No, it's not integrity. I have integrity, and I've looked at all the evidences for Christianity. I've looked at the evidences for other religions, I know what's out there, and I happen to know that if a person's only reading people who are criticizing Christianity, but they're not really being critical of those arguments, then, of course, they're going to lean more and more toward skepticism. But I think a Christian should be very skeptical of of everything for which there's no evidence. Now, there's plenty of evidence for the Bible. I mean, the historical narrative of the Bible has been confirmed again and again and again through archaeology, through comparison with ancient historical records from other societies around Israel and so forth. I mean, it's not, even the life of Jesus is confirmed by secular historians of ancient times and so forth. So, I mean, if you have evidence for something, then I think you shouldn't reject it in favor of something for which you have no evidence. Now, for example, an atheist has no evidence that there's no God, because there can be no, in the nature of the claim, there can be no evidence that there's no God. You can't have evidence for a universal negative. So I mean, if a person says, well, I've become an atheist because, I find too many problems in the Bible, and so I'm giving up my belief in the Bible, I'm going to believe in atheism. Well, there's more problems with atheism than there are in the Bible, and the ones in the Bible actually have solutions that a reasonable person can readily accept if they know them and think clearly about them. I think what we have happening in many cases, Mike, is that it's becoming very unpopular to take Christian positions about things, socially and philosophically. Yeah. I think, if people have the fear of man and they fear rejection, and they fear being looked at like they're not cool, then they might say, it is kind of silly believing the Bible, I guess, because after all, whoever saw a man rise from the dead, whoever saw a man walk on water, I guess I don't believe that anymore. Well, these are not honest people. They're not approaching the question with the honesty of someone who really wants to follow the evidence. And by the way, this doesn't make them unusually dishonest. Most people are fairly dishonest in some respects. Most people will not follow the evidence objectively on something that they're finding it unpopular to believe. And so there's a lot of factors. Yeah, ignorance is certainly one factor. I think lack of honesty is another one. If somebody knows the evidence for Christianity and rejects it, I say they are doing it dishonestly, because if they applied the same standard of skepticism that they're applying to the evidence for Christianity, that skepticism would make them disbelieve everything else, including atheism.
Right, right. Well, I think there's a special type of ignorance that a person might have if they've been taught really poorly and they grew up teaching that. Mm-hmm. Because not only are they then ignorant of what Christ really is about, but they think that they do know. And that's really hard being in that position and then still take Christianity seriously. You know what I mean?
I know that, yeah.
So
I mean, a lot of kids, a lot of empathy for people. Yeah.
Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, a lot of people who are raised in Christian homes or churches have not really been very clearly taught of what the Bible really teaches. They know some Bible stories, right. Maybe. They've heard some kind of a version of the gospel that they don't fully understand. And when they get older, they say, yeah, this stuff doesn't make sense. But in many cases, it's because they've never heard it taught in a way that adults would understand it. You know, they've been taught it as children in a childlike way. And they've never revisited the subject coming from an adult level of intelligence and recognizing, wow, this is, it's not as simplistic as what I thought it was. And in many cases, unfortunately, this Christian upbringing has inoculated them from curiosity. And I think that's what you're saying, that if they didn't think they knew, they might be more interested in exploring. But because they were raised in what they understand to be Christianity, they figure they know, and therefore, you know, no sense looking into it. I've been there and done that. You know, I got the T-shirt. So they feel that they know already, which in many cases they really don't. I know this for a fact.
Right.
Many of the young Christian, formerly Christian young people I know.
And, well, in the instance of Mormonism, for example, Joseph Smith used a lot of language that sounded like Bible language.
Yeah.
But he used it to manipulate people. He used it to abuse people. And once you see that, depending on a person's personality, like my wife, for example, she just feels like she feels like people use their faith in Christ to manipulate people, and so she has a really hard time looking objectively at right, and so she has that trauma of being manipulated, and so when she looks at the scriptures, it's really hard for her to see past that. And, you know, so I'm as patient with her as I possibly can be. But I'm realizing that yes, there's integrity. And there's also, it seems to me that there's a lot of things going on. And if we're as careful as possible, we might be able to help people through those things. But,
yeah, I think so. It might be slower going with those who think they've already had exposure to it because their exposure has been inadequate, but they don't know that.
Right. And those who have been abused in those situations in the context of Christianity or church, unfortunately that happens. But, well, I really appreciate everything you do, Steve. There's a few Bible teachers that I'm always excited to send people to when they do have questions about what I believe now that I'm not Mormon, and you're one of them. The pastor at the church I've been going to, you met Brandon Funk. He's at the Mennonite Church and at Fairview Mennonite Church.
Yeah, I like
He's
him.
An awesome Bible
like
teacher.
Him, yeah.
So
I'm glad you're going.
I really
there.
Appreciate what you do. It's a great church. It's been really good to be there, be among Christians who are just. They really care about following Jesus, and it's the emphasis. Everything there is on that, so it's been great. But I appreciate what you do. Thanks, Steve.
Okay, Mike, I appreciate your call. God bless you.
God bless you. Bye.
All right. Bye now. Okay, rather than take the next call at this point, I'm going to wait till after our break. We have a break at the bottom of the hour. And that would just interrupt my conversation with Rodney from Michigan, who's our next caller. So, Rodney, hang on, and we've got other callers waiting, too, for the second half hour of the show. At the halfway point, which is where we are, is when we like to make sure our listeners know that the Narrow Path is listener-supported. Now, of course, regular listeners know that, because I say it every day, but we've got newer listeners. And they may not know this. They may not have noticed that we've just gone a half hour with no commercial breaks, And in a moment, we're going to start another half hour and go through it without any commercial breaks, without anything for sale. We sell nothing on the program. We sell nothing on our website. In fact, we don't sell anything anywhere at all, nor do we let other vendors sell during our radio program. We're not here to run a business. we don't have any underwriters. We don't have a church, paying the bills here. And we don't have any salaries. If you donate money to the Narrow Path, I'll tell you where it's going to go. It's going to go to the radio station, probably the one you're listening to or some other one that needs support, so that we can continue on the air as we have been for the last 25 years. We're on stations all across the country, and this costs a bunch of money, but the Lord does provide, and he does because, well, there's people like you who would like for us to stay on. If you'd like to write to us, you can at The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. Or you can go to our website, thenarrowpath.com, where everything is free, but you can donate there if you want to. You'll find a place where you can do that at thenarrowpath.com. Excuse me. I will be back in just 30 seconds, so don't go away. We have another half hour coming up.
As you know, the Narrow Path Radio Show is Bible radio that has nothing to sell you, but everything to give you. So do the right thing and share what you know with your family and friends. Tell them to tune in to The Narrow Path on this radio station or go to thenarrowpath.com, where they will find topical audio teachings, blog articles, verse-by-verse teachings, and archives of all the radio shows. You know listeners supported Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. Share what you know.
Welcome back to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we are live again now for another half hour. For the rest of the program, we'll be taking your calls as we did for the first half. The number to reach us here is 844-484-5737. And I might just let you know in advance, tomorrow and the next day we will not be live. This is against my preferences, but it sometimes has to be. I'm going to be in the air during showtime tomorrow. I'll be in an airplane. I'm flying to St. Louis. And on the weekend, I'll be speaking at a number of places, including on Friday. Unfortunately, where I'm speaking is going to be interfering with the live broadcast, too. So we have 2 days in a row. And then there was Monday because it was a holiday. So this week, we only have 2 days live, yesterday and today. So what you can expect when you listen tomorrow or the next day, you'll find a show that sounds exactly like these. I mean, it's the same kind of thing, but it's just a collection of calls from the past. So listen in, even if it's not live, but you won't be able to call in. If you want to call in today, the number is 844-484-5737. And don't forget, there's a Zoom meeting tonight for anyone who's interested in joining us for a Q&A on Zoom. If you're interested in joining us for that, go to thenarrowpath.com, look under announcements, and the login information for the Zoom meeting will be there. All right, we're going to talk to Rodney from Michigan next. Rodney, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for taking my call.
Uh-huh.
I just wanted to balance comment from a question from yesterday.
Okay.
About the nation of Israel and the dispensational view.
Sure.
I'm a dispensationalist. I don't believe in a pre-trib rapture, or I don't really believe in the seven-year tribulation. Although I do believe there will be a tribulation before Christ comes at the end. I do believe most of the book of Revelation is about that. But my specific question is, I believe that God has been and always will be interested in Israel, particularly the bloodline. And the two scriptures I want to point and get your opinion on is Romans chapters 10 and 11, specifically chapter 11, where Paul is specifically asked the question that if God has cast off his people being the bloodline, because Paul goes on to say that he is an Israelite and from the tribe of Benjamin. So it's talking about the bloodline, and Paul goes on to say that, you know, God basically has not cast off his people. God has always left a remnant. And until the time of when the time of the Gentiles be fulfilled, that God will once again, you know, reunite the bloodline, a certain remnant. I believe like Revelation talks about the 144,000, which in my opinion is the remnant in the last days. And one other scripture there's many scriptures in the Old Testament, but particularly Ezekiel 37 about the Valley of Dry Bones, where God says that he will gather Israel from the heathen, and he will reunite the nation, and they will no longer be two separate entities, and he will dwell with them forever, and David, their prince, will be prince over them forever, which would be a reference to Christ. So, I mean, it uses that language in many scriptures of the Old Testament about regathering from, not just the regathering from like Babylon, but from all nations that held Israel captive. I just want to get your opinion on that.
Sure, be glad to give it. First of all, on that wording in Ezekiel, what I'm going to gather you from all the nations where I've scattered you, you're going to have to realize that he's talking about how the fact that he had already scattered them. That's in the past tense, where I have scattered you. This is very common in both Jeremiah and in Ezekiel, which were written concerning the Babylonian exile. And God had, in fact, scattered them to many nations. Babylonian Empire that conquered them had conquered many nations, and those nations, their captives were distributed all over the place. The Jews were in many nations that were under Babylonian control. And so you'll find Jeremiah and Ezekiel both, if you just do like a concordance search, I think you'll find a number of cases where he talks about, I will gather them from all the nations where I have scattered them. Well, he says he has scattered them already. In Jeremiah and Ezekiel, he had already scattered them to the many nations. And it's those nations that he had scattered them to that he'd gather them from. This happened, of course, only when Babylon fell to the Persians, and Cyrus made a decree that allowed all the Jews in Babylonian dominions who wished to could return to their land, and the remnant did. Now, so I don't think that that's making that point. I think that the dry bones seems clearly to be talking about the Jews who were currently in the Babylonian Empire as captives. I mean, he says these bones are the whole house of Israel. They say our bones are dried and our hope is lost. He's describing the current opinion of the Jews in Ezekiel's day. He says this: Israel is saying this. And sure they were, because they were in Babylon as captives. And God says they say our bones are dry, our hope is gone, our hope is lost. He says, yeah, but I'm going to bring them back. And he did. So, I mean, I don't see any reason to look beyond, about 539 B.C. for the fulfillment of that one. Now, as far as Romans goes, of course, Romans was written after the Jews had returned from exile. But Paul doesn't talk about them returning. And I don't know that I would see anything there in the verses you mentioned that said something about the bloodline, because you said that God wants to preserve the bloodline, but you then said the 144,000 in Revelation are them. Are you of the opinion there will only be 144,000 people of that bloodline left in the future?
Well, not really. I believe that God particularly talks in Revelation about a preserved remnant from all tribes, but there's obviously going to be multitudes other than that saved, especially in the last days before Christ comes back. So, but as far as the bloodline goes, I do believe that it's talking about a specific remnant that God's going to keep to himself from every tribe, just like he always has throughout the whole Bible.
Well, yeah, and he has. He has. There is a remnant of Israel that are saved. They follow Jesus.
I think Paul
Christ
mentions in Romans about that when he's answering that specific question about the bloodline.
Yeah, and
no,
what
he's
did
not
he
talking
say?
About the church. He's talking about the bloodline because
God casts
off his people.
Right. Well, let's just see if he's talking about the church, because he says, "I say then," this is Romans 11:1, "has God cast away his people?" Now, who are God's people? I guess you're assuming it's Israel. I'm not sure why you would assume that. In Hosea, God said to Israel when they were apostate, which they have been ever since Hosea's time, even in Paul's time, in our time, most Israelites are apostate from God. And God said in Hosea to them, you're not my people. So, if God says to Israel in Hosea chapter 1, they're not his people because they're apostate, then I don't know why you'd think that Paul in Romans 11 would say that the apostate Israel are God's people. No, who are God's people? Jesus, who are my mother? Who are my brothers? Who are my sisters? Those who do the will of my Father in heaven are my mother and brothers. So he goes on, certainly not, Paul says, he hasn't cast off his people, for I'm also an Israelite of the seed of Abraham, the tribe of Benjamin, meaning he hasn't cast me off, and I'm one of them. You know, so obviously he hasn't cast them all off. He says, God has not cast away his people whom he foreknew. Ah, he has not cast away his people whom he foreknew, Paul says. Well, who are the ones that God foreknew? Well, Paul has used that expression one time a couple chapters back in chapter 8. He says, whom he foreknew, he predestined to be conformed to the image of his son. And that's the Christians. The Christians are the ones that he foreknew. And Paul was a Christian too, so he identifies himself. Yeah, he was of the Jewish bloodline, that's true. But he's not an unconverted Jew. He's a Christian Jew. He's one of the ones that God foreknew. And then he goes on, and he says in verse 5, even so then, at this present time, in Paul's own day, he says, there is a remnant according to the election of grace. So you were just telling me that God has an interest in preserving a remnant of the Jewish people to be saved. Paul agrees, but it's not some future group of people. He says, he's writing 2,000 years ago. He says, even so at this present time, there is a remnant. And he identified himself as one of the people in that remnant. So who are these remnants? Well, they are the ones who are elect according to the election of grace. Sounds like they're the ones who are Christians. Whenever Paul talks about the election in his letters, he's talking about the church. So Paul is saying, no, God hasn't cast off his people, regardless of their bloodline. I mean, if we want to consider the Jewish bloodline, has he cast off all the Jews? No, there's a remnant of them that he saved, Paul being one of them, and many others besides. There's a lot of them. But see, that's already happened. Paul's not talking about anything in the future. He says, at this present time. He says, God has not cast them off. Well, he's not talking about some future. He's using past tense and present tense. So there's no predictions here about something future for them. Now, you mentioned chapter 11 talking about, all Israel being saved. But he describes what he means by that in the verses just prior to that, when he says that the olive tree, Israel, has on it believing Jews as branches and believing Gentiles as branches. He said the unbelieving Jews are branches that have been broken off, and unbelieving Gentiles are branches that never have been put on it. So Israel, the olive tree, is comprised of believing Jews and believing Gentiles. Well, the only entity I know of that's comprised of believing Jews and believing Gentiles is what we call the church, and that's what he's talking about. That's the true Israel. That's all the Israel that will be saved. When he says all Israel will be saved, notice before he says all Israel will be saved, he says in this way all Israel will be saved. Now, that's an important point. If we're going to exegete Scripture, we need to look at the actual prepositions and words in the verses, or else we'll miss what's being said. In Romans 11:26, Paul says, in this way, all Israel will be saved. In what way? What has he just described? He's just described the true believing Jews remaining in the tree and the unbelieving Jews being removed from the tree, and then the addition of believing Gentile branches into the tree. In this way, all Israel, the whole tree is Israel, but all Israel means the Jewish branches and the Gentile branches. We have been grafted in with the believing Jews into the church. Remember, the believing Jews, there were 3,000 of them on the day of Pentecost, and then there were many thousands more later before Gentiles were allowed to be grafted in, but eventually Gentiles have been able to be grafted in. But the Gentiles weren't grafted into something other than the remnant of Israel. It was the remnant of Israel in the upper room upon whom God poured out his Spirit as he promised in the Old Testament. In fact, if we should really become acquainted with this idea of the remnant, because that's what the New Testament says we are. But in the passage in Joel 2, that Peter said was fulfilled at Pentecost. It begins at verse 28. It shall come to pass afterward that I'll pour my spirit on all flesh, and your sons and daughters will prophesy. We know that verse. That's fulfilled at Pentecost. And Peter quotes that verse up until, the middle of verse 32, that whoever calls on the name of the Lord shall be saved. But it goes on and says, for in Mount Zion and in Jerusalem there shall be salvation, as the Lord has said, among the remnant whom the Lord calls. Okay, so he's going to pour out his spirit on all flesh. Who's he going to pour it out on? On the remnant whom the Lord calls. Remember, Peter said on the day of Pentecost, the promise is to you and your children and as many as the Lord shall call. So those that God has called are the Christians, in this case, Jewish Christians. But a Jewish Christian is a Christian just like a Gentile Christian. There's no Jew or Gentile in Christ. All Christians are Christians for the same reason, not because of their bloodline. Now, when Paul does talk about his bloodline in Romans 11, he's pointing out that God hasn't rejected everybody of that bloodline. God made it very clear in Jeremiah, he never will. He never will reject everyone of that bloodline. And he never did. Jesus was of that bloodline. The apostles were of that bloodline. All the early Christians for the first several years were of that bloodline. And many Christians to this day are of that bloodline. Many Jewish Christians today. But so, I mean, God did not cast off that bloodline. What he has cast off is people who don't believe, Jews and Gentiles. And what he has included in Israel are those who do believe, which is Jews and Gentiles. So that's how I would understand those concepts. I appreciate your call, brother. I need to try to get some more calls in. My lines are pretty full here. Let's see. Kevin from Burbank, California. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Well, I really appreciate your program. I wanted to talk about Max the Atheist, who called in last week. But I wanted to make a quick point about the caller that just called in. It appears that the dispensational Christian doesn't know who their mother is. In other words, Galatians 4:26 says that the Jerusalem above is the mother of us all. So it seems like the church is both the bride and the wife simultaneously, because the father is already having a relationship with his wife and producing children, right?
Right. Yeah, Paul said in Romans chapter 7, verse 4, that we have died to the law so we could be married to another, even him that rose from the dead, so that we might bring forth fruit for God. Certainly he expects us to be bringing forth fruit for God now. So he sees us as married to the one who rose from the dead.
Absolutely.
And the church, the church is the Jerusalem above that is free, who is the mother of us all. Right.
Amen. And then for Max the Atheist, who called in, I really appreciate him calling in and challenging you. But he was going to call back and challenge you based on prophecy being weak, one of the weak points of Christianity. And actually, in Isaiah 41:20-23, God in the Old Testament actually uses prophecy to prove that he is the real God.
Yeah.
Because he says, have the other idols come in and prophesy that something's going to take place and take place to prove that you're God. So actually, prophecy, the ability to prophesy something's going to happen, is a proof that he's the legitimate God.
Well, I agree. I don't know what Max would agree with, but he's the next caller in line, actually. So he's coming on right after you.
Oh, well, he was talking about the faithfulness to God. He was talking about there was another person that was studying another religion, and that person felt like that was God, the real God. But you basically said last week, what if it's the false God? So I'll end my call and let you speak with Brother Max. Thank you very much.
Okay, Kevin. Good to hear from you again. Bye now.
Bye.
Yeah, if I could just clarify that conversation with Max, who is our next caller? Last time he called, he was saying that, if people leave, he was talking about a comment I made some weeks ago, that people who have come to Christ, been baptized, made their commitment to Christ, and then later left Christ, that they have simply been unfaithful to their vows. And he said, well, what about somebody who leaves Hinduism or Islam or some other religion and becomes a Christian? Do you think they're unfaithful to their vows? And my position is the vows that are made to a God that doesn't exist don't have any binding force because they made vows to somebody who doesn't exist, whereas the real God does exist. It's like if I made vows to an imaginary woman that I'd marry her and be faithful to her for life, and then I met a real woman and I want to be married to her, I would not feel any obligation to keep vows to an imaginary woman who doesn't exist. And likewise, people who worship a God who doesn't exist, to abandon that deception in order to follow the one who does exist would not be the same thing as abandoning the true God. And then, of course, he was saying, well, how do you know you're the true God? And this is what we got into. I don't know if Max is going to pick up from there and keep going, or if he has something else to discuss today. Hi, Max. Welcome back.
Thank you. I want to just first of all say everybody tune into the Zoom call this evening at 7 p.m. You can find it on Steve's website, the info there.
You going to join us, Max?
I hope to, yeah. I certainly hope
Good.
To, yes.
Good.
In regards to, I believe, Kevin, from the caller from Burbank, any day of the week, any time of night or day, I'd be happy to put the powers of scientific methodology and the predictive powers of that up against anybody's prophecy at any point. Because my methodology can predict where new planets are, can predict where your, you know, when creationists say, oh, well, where are the transitional forms from like a fish to a land animal? We knew when and where they would be. It was tectonic in the Devonian. We went to a place in Canada. We dug in that area, and we found that transitional form. So we have predictive powers that surpass any kind of religious prophetic claims.
Well, do you think if a modern scientist, armed with every modern scientific device and testing tool or whatever that we have now, could be somehow magically transported back to the time of, let's say, 700 B.C.
Magically transported. Steve,
yeah.
The second you say scientific and you say magically transported, that's where the cognitive dissonance begins.
Okay,
and
ends. This is a hypothetical question. Suppose a man, armed with all kinds of scientific knowledge, found himself inexplicably, maybe a UFO took him there, okay? Maybe there's some scientific explanation for how he got there, but he found himself unexpectedly living in the 7th century or 8th century B.C. Do you think that he would be able to predict that 200 years after his time, a man named Cyrus, who would not yet be born for 150 years, would conquer the Babylonian Empire and become the ruler of the world? Do you think a person by scientific methods would be able to make that prediction?
I can tell you exactly what a person armed with my scientific methodology could do if they awoke in the Twilight Zone and found themselves transported with all of their knowledge of how the world actually works back in time. The first thing I would do, Steve, is I would get some quartz or some glass, and I would grind together some lenses and build a very rudimentary telescope. And I would have them look at the planet Jupiter, which they worshipped and named Jupiter or Zeus because they thought it was a god. And I would tell them, you know, when we look at this point of light through my telescope that I've constructed, we're going to see four small moons. And these moons are going to move and change around in a way that that I can describe and predict. And when I did that, they would either A, worship me, or B, crucify me as a witch, or maybe C, realize that they had been wrong and develop a scientific methodology.
Okay, let me ask you this. Okay, that's irrelevant to the question I asked you, so I'm going to bring it back up again, but let me just address the point you made, and then we'll get back to the question I asked you. So were you able to predict that there were four moons around Jupiter before anyone saw them?
No.
Okay, so the scientific method could not predict how many moons you would find around Jupiter. They had to be discovered just like everything else has to be discovered by the scientific method. It doesn't predict future events that for which there's no evidence yet. Now, I asked you, Do you think a person...
It can predict future events.
Okay.
We can predict future events. You can't.
Okay. Well,
we can predict the weather.
No, I
can't. We can predict climate change. We can predict the prognosis of a disease once it's been... Once a person has it, we can predict
of course. Of course.
How a person will respond to different treatments.
Okay, and you know what? A scientist who believes... I just put you on hold so I could... Because the clock is running out. I just need to get some words in here. A person who believes in the Bible could predict all those things, too, from the scientific method. The Bible does not, and Christians do not take the position that science plays no role in our knowledge. There are things you can discover through the scientific method. And if you had those methods, you could discover those same things back 2,000 years ago or 3,000 years ago if you had those methods available to you. Right. This does not make any point against Christianity, because Christianity has never had any problem with science. Science, in fact, developed in Christian lands where it did not in other lands, mainly because the Christian worldview encouraged it, and most of the great leaders in modern science were believers in the Bible. That doesn't make the Bible true, but I'm saying that believing the Bible is not in conflict with scientific knowledge, because as Stephen Jay Gould said, they address separate domains. Science can be practiced by a Christian believer or an atheist with equal facility, and it doesn't really overlap. However, the ability, let me just say now, let's take the greatest science community there is right now and say, give them this task of telling us who, by name, will be ruling the world 200 years from now. Now, and give them all the scientific method they got. Say, give us the name of the man who will be ruling the world 200 years from now. Do you think they could do that?
Probably not with any certain accuracy, no.
Right, because that's not what science studies, you see. Science doesn't have access to that kind of information. Science has access to a great deal of information that was not available to people in pre-scientific times. You've got that right. But to say that science has been a great boon doesn't tell us anything about whether the Bible is true or whether the prophets had divine revelation about things that no science of any time could ever have told them.
Steve, I wanted to call up and start from the very beginning of the Bible. So if we can look in Genesis here and we see that fruits and trees and vegetation are made on day number three, and then stars are dated on day number four, that makes zero scientific sense, because stars are billions of years older than trees. So from the get-go, the Bible is scientifically, from what we can just objectively observe in the universe, is just dead wrong. So why should we trust it?
Well,
I trust it. That being wrong continues for quite a few things, by the way. If the Bible is true, we should be able to
objectively
test it and see it proved by some.
Okay. Well, that's not always true. Not everything that's historic can be verified scientifically. For example, Abraham lived 2,000 years ago. You probably can't find any scientific test to determine that he did. It's just that's not in the realm of science. That's in the realm of recorded history. You see, science is not the only place we get information from. We get information from science about the natural world. We get information from history and archaeology about, ancient events. But those are not following scientific methods. Those are following a different kind of discipline. You find things about God from people that God has revealed himself to and who he's inspired. As far as the creation story, I'd love to get into that more. As you can tell, the music's playing. I'm going to be cut off here myself in about half a minute. Excuse me. If I keep mumbling, it'll be less than that. So we can talk about that again, but we have to focus on that sometime and not be spreading our thoughts all over the place, because that obviously requires focus. You've been listening to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg. We are listener-supported. You can go to our website, thenarrowpath.com, to see where I'll be speaking and to access our free resources. Have a good evening. God bless.